This is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. And today's show is going to be basically largely an interview that Ali Abu Nima and Nora Barros Friedman of the Electronic Intifada conducted with the great Jewish historian Ilan Pape, who, if you haven't read The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, I think it's one of the most recommended books in terms of the history of Palestine. And it's largely recommended because of its accessibility. It's written in non-academic language that people can learn this history and see that it's not as complex as people make it out to be, that there's two sides to the story, etc. Having said that, and before I introduce the segment, I just wanted to say that the only piece of news I wanted to relay today is obviously something you heard, that at the Security Council vote, there were 14 countries that voted in support of a ceasefire, and the United States abstained, and Netanyahu got very upset because he wanted the United States to object and to veto again, which they've done three times before, but they didn't, and so he canceled the delegation, the Israeli delegation's trip to Washington. I just wanted to say that this is a complete farce. The fact that it came out in the press conferences that what's happening really is this is something that the United States wanted to do. It's totally performative, because the weapons are still being sent, complicity with Israeli government stopping humanitarian aid is there with the United States. The United States is actively participating in the blocking of aid. We can talk about that at length, how that's happening. Along with the 100 shipments of weaponry that's been sent in increments so that they can avoid any kind of voting on these shipments. So all this to say is, like, this is purely symbolic, and on behalf of the, like, on the part of the Biden administration, it's purely performative stuff. So don't be fooled by it, and keep on fighting, keep on hitting the streets, keep on fighting the presidents of your institutions, especially I'm talking about colleges. Keep on organizing, keep on interrupting the speeches. Hopefully we'll interrupt Biden this Sunday at his church in Georgetown, Easter Sunday, if he shows up. But people are doing the work. People have not given up, and in fact, they've increased their activism, and that's tremendous. Every time I think of an action that we, creative action, we should do, somebody comes up with even a better action, and it's already in progress by the time I suggest something. And also, just the demonstration at the 9:30 Club here in Washington, D.C. last week was one demonstration of how creative the activists and how on it they are. The 9:30 Club hosted a racist, like, kind of white reggae guy that's appropriating, a Zionist basically, who performs for the IDF, for the Israeli army, who appropriates Afro-Caribbean culture to basically promote a settler colonial state of Israel. And activists came out and blocked the street in front of the 9:30 Club, and set up a DJ stand, and we played. They played. There were three DJs, including my friend Abby, who plays here on Friday nights at 10 o'clock. Plays amazing sets. She played an incredible set of music, and we were basically blasting the 9:30 Club. And I ask you to boycott the 9:30 Club until they come up with a statement, and we can judge them later. But the 9:30 Club is hereby canceled, is hereby a boycott target, because the owner of the 9:30 Club received over 1,200 emails that called for the cancellation of this so-called artist, this singer, and he turned it down. Somebody was telling me that the 9:30 Club has never canceled a concert due to political content, but this is a genocide. This is unexcusable that he would host somebody who's a racist, who's a white settler racist, who's an anti-Palestinian racist, who's an anti-Arab racist, who supports genocide and the killing of children. That's unacceptable. That's a reason to make an exception this time and cancel an artist because of the political context. Just like you would cancel if we found out an artist was a Nazi or a member of the Ku Klux Klan. It's on par with all of these things. I urge you and to urge your friends to boycott the 9:30 Club until it feels the pain, just like major corporations like McDonald's and Starbucks are feeling the pain. Our local club, our beloved club, which is walking distance from my house, has just hosted a racist. And we're going to teach our local community, we're going to teach the owner of the 9:30 Club the consequences, that this is a different time. This is a different day than any day of this century. So with that, I wanted to introduce our segment today, which we'll play out the show with. It's a long interview on Electronic Intifada, where Ilan Pape first talks about what's happening in Gaza and then goes into why he thinks this is the beginning of the end of the Zionist project. So let's have a listen.
And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Coming up, we'll have an interview with physician Ben Thompson, and we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments in Gaza. But first, Ali, please introduce our first guest.
Thanks so much, Nora. It was so difficult to listen to a lot of that news, but thank you for that very thorough summary. I'm really delighted to introduce Ilan Pape. He's a professor of history at the University of Exeter in the UK and director of the European Centre for Palestine Studies. Many of you will know that Ilan gained renown as one of the new historians, a group of Israeli scholars who in the 1980s shattered longstanding Zionist lies about the founding of Israel and corroborated what Palestinians had been saying all along about the ethnic cleansing and massacres that they survived during the Nakba in 1948. He's the author of many, many books, far too many to mention here, but two of them are A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, and The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Ilan is also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada. He is, of course, a distinguished scholar, but he's also been a prominent and longtime advocate and voice for the liberation of Palestine from Zionism. And I hope I can also say that I consider Ilan to be a very dear friend as well. Welcome, Ilan.
Hello, Ali and everyone. It's a great pleasure and honor to be in the live stream with the Electronic Intifada, and thank you for your kind introduction.
Thank you, Ilan. First, let me just ask you how you're doing. We're all now, it's more than 5 months of this genocide, almost six, and I just want to ask you how you're doing.
It's very difficult. I find it difficult to concentrate on my regular work. I find it difficult to sleep. I'm fully aware of what goes on. It's heartbreaking. It's infuriating. And all one can do is double or triple our efforts, first of all, to stop the genocide, but continue also the long strategic aim of liberating Palestine. So personally, of course, all of us are preoccupied with this. We are not suffering as the people of Gaza do, but I'm definitely feel the pain, and this is for me, and I'm 70 years old, this year is the worst period I experienced personally in the history of modern Palestine.
I know that we all feel very similar. Ilan, we're going to discuss a lot of the issues you raised, but first I want to remind you, I'm sure you haven't forgotten, that in 2006 you wrote for the Electronic Intifada, and I quote, "A genocide is taking place in Gaza." You described this later as an incremental genocide, but 18 years ago you wrote these words: "Nothing apart from pressure in the form of sanctions, boycott, and divestment will stop the murdering of innocent civilians in the Gaza Strip. There is nothing we here in Israel can do against it. Brave pilots refuse to take part in the operations. Two journalists out of 150 do not cease to write about it, but this is it. In the name of the Holocaust memory, let us hope the world will not allow the genocide in Gaza to continue." You wrote that in 2006. Clearly, there is nothing incremental about the genocide today. Given your clarity about where Israel was headed back then, are you surprised by the savagery and brutality that Israel is perpetrating today?
I must say that although I did expect a very brutal and ruthless Israeli reaction to the operation of the Hamas on October the 7th, I did not foresee them such a magnitude of inhumanity and such a level of criminality and dehumanization as Israel has inflicted on the people of Gaza. I mean, I did anticipate a very ruthless and violent reaction, but I must say that this is beyond anything I could imagine. And I think you're absolutely right. Whereas I think the years of siege were incremental genocide in the sense of creating conditions which were uninhabitable for people in Gaza. This is a genocide that is taking place in front of our eyes on a daily basis. It's nothing incremental about it. And it's really a vicious, intentional attempt to use the 7th of October as a pretext to deal with what Israel has been unable to deal with, which is the presence of nearly 2 million Palestinians in this part of historical Palestine. And they seem to think that they have now an historical opportunity, and there is no moral inhibition in implementing the idea of removing Gaza or, wiping out or erasing Gaza, the strip, not just the city, the strip as a whole, from the map of Palestine.
Ilan, you have a unique perspective as an Israeli who's completely rejected Zionism, and yet Israel is the society you grew up in. Tell us about what you see happening inside Israel 48 today. What are the political and social realities that have brought us to this point where seemingly an entire society is united around the goal of the extermination of a people they've already, for 80 years, a century, subjected to dispossession, occupation, apartheid, and persecution?
You know, in 1999, I wrote an article for the Journal of Palestine Studies examining the Israeli educational system, cultural system, and political system. And I argued in that article in 1999 that the next generations of Israelis who will go through the official Israeli educational system, through the socialization in the army, through the media indoctrination, would become even worse than the early Zionist settlers, become a group of supremacist, racist, a group of people that would inflict disasters not only on historical Palestine, but also in the area around Palestine. I'm afraid I was totally correct in this assessment. And this was based on, you know, analyzing the content of the textbook, the curricula, and the basic messages that young Israeli Jews were getting through the various socialization systems in Israel. So what we see now, namely the fact that more than 97% of the Israelis support the genocide in Gaza, is not surprising, unfortunately. It's a society that is used to dehumanize the Palestinians ever since it set foot in Palestine in the late 19th century, in particular when its leaders committed the ethnic cleansing of 1948. You cannot massively kill people. You cannot be totally indifferent to the death of babies, for babies operated without anesthetics, to children burying children, and for your own army committing one war crime after the other, unless you totally dehumanize the victims of these kinds of policies. And dehumanization doesn't come easily to people, contrary to what people think. You need to work on it. You need to socialize people. You need to indoctrinate them to such a level. But this is a fact now. And the fact is that, of course, there are Israeli individuals who are not like that, thank God. There are not all of them like that, but the vast majority are. And this includes the soldiers in the Gaza Strip, the generals, the pundits who comment in the Israeli media about the actions, not to mention, of course, the political leaders. And therefore, we come back to the point we already made before, that don't expect for a change within Israel to occur in order, if you are wishing, like all of us should wish, for these terrible crimes against the Palestinians to cease. If you really want to stop genocide, and let's not forget the killing of 400 people in the West Bank, if you really want to stop these policies now and those that Israel is planning in the future, the only way is a pressure from the outside. There are moments in history where you cannot rely on a rogue state to change from within, and it has to be pressured to change. And there are the means of doing it, as we have seen in the case of apartheid South Africa and similar cases in history.
We're definitely going to talk about that, but we want to take advantage of your deep knowledge and scholarship and go back to some more historical context. Some 80% of the population in Gaza are refugees from cities, towns, and villages that are now part of Israel, the 1948 areas, including the lands where some of the kibbutzes that were raided on the 7th of October have been built. Talk to us about the history of the so-called Gaza envelope, of the people in Gaza, and what Israel's policy towards them has been.
Yes, I think it's a very important point, Ali, because people may think that there always was a Gaza Strip. Before 1948, there was no Gaza Strip. There was a town called Gaza and small and large villages around it. On the road, the Via Maris, the main road on the Mediterranean between Alexandria in Egypt and Alexandretta in Turkey. It was a very pastoral place and very cosmopolitical because so many people were using the road and going through Gaza. It had all three religions were represented in the town of Gaza, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews. And it was quite a beautiful spot in historical Palestine. When Israel began its ethnic cleansing, it was trying to massively move people outside the borders of what became the state of Israel. So people were moved, Palestinians were moved to the north, to Lebanon and Syria, and to the east, to Jordan. However, the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were removed and pushed by force from the center and south of Palestine were directed towards Egypt, but Egypt did not, was unwilling to accept the Palestinian refugees. So the Israeli leaders decided to concede, in inverted commas, 2% of Palestine, although they had the power to occupy it, and create this rectangle that became the Strip as a receptor for all these hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that they have expelled from the central and south of Palestine. Now, the last wave of expulsion was exactly from those villages on whose ruins some of the settlements that were attacked on the 7th of October were built. We have in the Israeli archive a document from the 25th of November, 1948, called Order Number 40, which is sent from the central command to the commanders in the area that today would be called the area around Gaza. And it lists 11 villages, and the order is to burn them and expel the people from them to Gaza. On the ruins of these villages, the settlements were built. So what you have in Gaza is a second and a third generation of people who were not just removed forcefully from the rest of Palestine, but also people who are direct descendants of the people who were expelled from the villages on which the kibbutzim and development towns were built around the present Gaza Strip.
And also, Ilan, talk about, and by the way, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke about a story I'd written with David Sheen, which focused on, I think it was Kibbutz Nir Oz, which is one of several kibbutzes built on the land of Al-Ma'in, a Palestinian community, which was largely the home of members of the Abu Sitte family, including Salman Abu Sitte, who has written himself about what he witnessed in 1948 as a child. And the land of Al-Ma'in and the Abu Sitte family is now where several of these kibbutzes sit. Talk to us also about the city of Al-Majdal, Asqalan, which is now Ashkelon, because I think many people know that most of the Palestinians were expelled in 1948, starting in 1947, in 1948. But the expulsions did not stop after 1948, after the establishment of the State of Israel. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. And it was not out of a strategic decision because of technical issues that had to do with some problem of coordination in the Israeli army. The thousands of people who lived in Majdal Askelan were not expelled in 1948. And they were instead enclaved in an area which the Israeli military governors themselves called the ghetto. And in the ghetto, in Majdal Askelan, in the ghetto, most of the population of Majdal Askelan lived between 1948 until 1950. And while they were living in those enclaves, the Israeli Jewish city of Ashkelon was built around them. In 1950, it was this, the Israeli army decided to, was a rather political decision by the government led by David Ben-Gurion, that this is not a very healthy situation for the new immigrants who were sent to Ashkelon, many of them coming from Arab countries. And there was always a worry that, you know, the Arab Jews and the Palestinians might find a common conversation, a common basis for a dialogue and so on. So it was decided to forcefully add them to the people who were already refugees in the Gaza Strip. And because this is 1950 and there's already new reporters, Israeli reporters and other reporters, we have quite an extensive documentation on the very process of the expulsion, namely the fact that people were shot above their heads to make sure that they leave. Ironically, Israel was expelling thousands of people who were regarded as citizens of Israel, according to the independence declaration of the State of Israel, boasting equality for everyone. The only reason that they were expelled was that they were Palestinians. And that is important. And as you rightly say, this did not only happen in Ashkelon, in Majd al-Ashkelon. Between 1948 and 1967, and especially in the first 10 years of Israel's statehood, dozens of Palestinian villages were emptied by force by the Israeli army on the borders with Lebanon, Jordan, and expelled to the other side of the border.
You mentioned, Ilan, that many of the people that Israel moved into the former lands and homes of the Palestinians around what is now the Gaza Strip were Arab Jews. Talk about that. Why did they send Arab Jews to those areas? And what role did Arab Jews play in the establishment of Israel?
The Zionist movement original impulse was to create a European Jewish state on the ruins of Palestine. And until 1948, the Zionist leadership showed very little interest in the Jewish communities in the Arab world for two reasons. One, these communities did not suffer from anti-Semitism, and therefore there was no impulse in those communities compared to the communities in Central and Eastern Europe in particular, to leave a place where they lived for hundreds, and in the case of Iraq, thousands of years. So that's one reason that it was not easy to induce them anyway to come. And secondly, until 1948, they were regarded as Arabs, and therefore there was no wish by the European Zionist leadership to Arabize the Zionist project, so to speak. However, after the Holocaust and the loss of 6 million Jews in Europe, and the fact that a lot of Jewish survivors from the Holocaust did not choose Israel as their destination, and preferred to go to England, the United States, or even go back to some of the European countries from which they originally came, there was a demographic need, or Israel wanted a demographic injunction to increase the number of Jews in Israel. And there, after 1948, Israel began a massive campaign to try and persuade the Jews from Arab countries to come to Israel. They use all kinds of methods, different ones. We don't have time, and maybe one day we can have a deeper conversation about it. But I will just give two examples to show how different communities had to be approached differently by Israel. In Yemen, where the community was far more religious, they spread the ideas and lied to the Jews of Yemen that Israel is a very theocratic religious place where, you know, Jews can practice Judaism, which of course was not the case in 1948. And in Iraq, they planted bombs in Iraqi synagogues in order to persuade the Jews to come to Israel. However, after they all came, about 1 million of them, they were still regarded by the Zionist leadership as Arabs. So they had to be de-Arabized. And there were several methods that were used to de-Arabize them. One was to locate them on the geographical margins of the state, near the boundaries with the Arab states, where it was very clear that these were very active borders in terms of frictions and clashes, and that would the hope was that it would increase their animosity towards the Arabs in general. Another way of doing it was to force them to change their names, to be totally alien to their roots and language, and so on. Unfortunately, even without that indoctrination, many, and especially this is particularly true about the North African Jews, they felt that the best way to be initiated or to be accepted as equals in the Israeli European Jewish society was to show animosity and hatred towards the Arabs in general and towards the Palestinians in particular. And that is why the right-wing parties in Israel, the more fascist parties and the more extreme ones, can rely on especially North African Jews to provide with them the electoral force in national elections. So they were used, they are victims, as Ella Shochat rightly says, they're also victims of Zionism. However, as can happen in societies, they, instead of directing their anger and their outrage towards the people who really victimized them, they thought that it's easier to direct it towards the Palestinians who had nothing to do with their suffering, with their uprootedness and a lack of equality within the Israeli Jewish society.
Ilan, I want to talk a little bit more about the kind of strategic location of these kibbutzim in the so-called Gaza envelope area and how the Israeli state has use these colonial settlements as kind of, you know, ramparts for, you know, military surveillance of the Gaza Strip. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy of Israeli policy of placing these, you know, these seemingly innocuous, you know, farmland, you know, the sort of they were branded as like a socialist utopia, these kibbutzes. But what intention was there in building them so close to what's now the Gaza Strip?
Well, this is typical of settler colonial movements. The settler colonial project is a structure. It never stops. And it has to occupy a land that belongs to indigenous people and occupy it again and again, because there's always a risk that the indigenous people would not sit peacefully when they are dispossessed from their land. So what happens is that you totally militarize the civil space. So any settlement, especially on the borderline between areas that have already been colonized in areas that haven't been yet colonized, those who sit on the border, on the one hand, they are civilians and they lead civic life, but on the other hand, they're also soldiers, they're also military, and therefore they carry guns and they are functioning as the outposts in a military sense towards the so-called enemy. So I think that they play a very important role in the colonization. First of all, historically, they played a very important role in the colonization. And of course, they play a contemporary role in policing the millions of Palestinians. In between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, there are millions of Palestinians. And Israel polices them in different ways. It uses the Jewish settlements in the West Bank in a similar way to be part of the policing of the oppressive matrix of power alongside military bases, alongside the secret service operation, and unfortunately also with collaboration with the Palestinian Authority in some places. And inside Israel, they're using the Jewish settlements in the Galilee and in the Nakab in a very similar way. So, they tried to do it in Gaza as well until 2005, but because Gaza doesn't mean much biblically, they couldn't get a large number of Jews to settle in Gaza itself. And that's when Sharon said it's much better to take them out and create this huge prison called Gaza and attack it from the outside without worrying of the fate of the settlers in the inside. If you think about it, the Hamas in many ways enabled us to go back to that situation where this pharmaceutical Israeli idea that Gaza can be totally disassociated from the from Israel and only be attacked without any danger to Israel. The Hamas always challenged that, first with the Hamas with the rockets and now with this particular operation. So I think yes, it's a kind of a reality where you know, probably best described as Israel being an army with a state rather than a state with an army.
Ilan, we could talk about you know, the history and the context is so important to understanding the present day, because you know, Israel and its supporters want us to believe history started on October 7th. And that's always, you know, history starts from whatever moment is most suitable to those powerful and to the oppressors. But you were so prescient all those years ago when you wrote about genocide in Gaza. And it wasn't a word that anyone used lightly about Israel's actions. It was almost unimaginable at that time to think that the International Court of Justice could be considering a case very seriously as to whether Israel is perpetrating genocide. And they've already found that it is a plausible case and ordered Israel to stop all genocidal acts, which, of course, Israel hasn't done. I want to ask you, thinking about the situation in Israel, where do you see things heading? What will it take to stop this genocide? What can pierce this fanaticism of this Israeli population? You alluded to that earlier, but I want you to explore that more.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I'm afraid that we have to, as painful as it is, distinguish between the very near future and the more distant future. I'm afraid that in the near future, although it seems that Israel is acting in such a way that we begin to see actions like the Canadian government's decision to stop suspend arms supplies to Israel and so on, that, you know, in terms of the BDS movement, we are beginning to see the S, the sanctions, and not just the boycott and divestment. But as we can notice, first of all, it's incremental, it's piecemeal, we don't even know whether it's really happening. Not that I'm underestimating the symbolic force of that. So I think it might have an accumulative impact on Israel, but knowing the Israeli society, it would have to be far more severe, far more direct, far more transparent that this is really happening. And it has to do with the treatment of Israeli sports teams in the world, music, arms sales, and so on. And, you know, whereas maybe the global south would move a bit quicker, I think, towards that kind of action, I'm afraid that the global north would take far more time, not to mention the United States, and God knows what the American elections would mean for that kind of action. So I'm afraid, if I'm very honest, if I'm bitterly honest, I cannot see an effective international action within a year or a year and a half. I can see it later on. I can see it later on. But by the way, I don't want to sound as if I would raise my hands and say there's nothing we can do because of that. No, I'm just saying that if we cannot be observers and think that this is a dynamics that happened by themselves. It means every one of us who is involved in this should double and triple their efforts and not kind of take for granted that, you know, the ICJ and later the ICC or other organization are strong enough at this moment in time to force Israel. There's also another problem with Israel. It can seem to accept certain things, and then it does them incrementally. It does them, you know, in a different way. But from the Palestinians' victims' point of view, it's the same kind of thing. So I don't have. I wish I had a successful formula for the next year or so. I see that the resistance continues. I think that we should pay attention to a possible more severe resistance in the West Bank. We don't yet know what will happen in the north of Israel or Palestine, but I think we have to take into account that you do not stop such a criminal act in one day. And it's terrible to say it because I know what it means on a daily basis, but I want to be brutally realistic here and not not promise something that isn't. But if I may, I do really believe, and this I say as a scholar, not just as an activist, I really see, and I said it before, and I'm going to say it again in every stage, as a scholar, I can see clear indications that the Zionist project is entering its last phase. It's the beginning of the end of this project. It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable from looking at it from the inside, the Jewish society. It's imploding from the inside. There is no cement that holds the various groups in Israel together. It's not sustainable because I think young Jews all over the world would stop equating Zionism with Judaism. It's not sustainable because the Palestinian younger generation have a much better vision and ideas of how to push forward the liberation struggle. And it's not sustainable because of Israel's economic problems and the possibilities of changes in the region and definitely in the way the international community treats Israel as a pariah state. However, these processes will take more time, but they will happen. So there is a kind of a dawn after this dark night, but I would be irresponsible if I would say that I know exactly how to end this night, terrible period today. But I do want to beseech anyone who's listening to us. It's working in a sense that you cannot see the full picture, but it works if it's relentless, if it doesn't stop, if everything we are doing is done 24/7 as much as we can, because I do think the more accumulative the impact is, the shorter the period in which Israel finally would be held to be accountable and maybe begin to pay the price that apartheid South Africa paid during the beginning of the sanctions when they started. The civil society actions of boycott and divestment are very important. But I think that we need to find a way of moving, as I said, between the B and D to the S. I think that's a very crucial idea. And if I may add to this, of course, we're still looking desperately at the Arab world and the Muslim world to do much, much more. And they can. They really can do much more than they have done so far. Without going into the domestic issues of their politics, even with the current regimes that are there, I don't think they have exhausted their possibilities of lending an effective hand to the overall efforts in the world to stop the genocide as soon as possible.
So, Ilan, you said that Israel is imploding in a way. The Zionist project is imploding. What does that mean? Do you think we can look forward 10, 20 years and say that Israel would still be there or Israel might be gone? I mean, at what, you know, I know that nobody can put a date on it, but where does this process of implosion lead in your view?
Yeah, I think what we can see quite clearly is a takeover of Israel by the more theocratic, more extreme group of Israelis, whom I called in one of my last pieces, the state of Judea, the state of the settlers, that takes over the state of Israel. I mean, both the State of Israel, which is the more liberal Zionist side, and the theocratic messianic Jewish side, the State of Judea, both of them, of course, believe in the apartheid system and occupation and colonization of Palestine, but they have different view of what the Israeli Jewish society should look from the inside. And I think all those Israelis who still think that they can uphold apartheid alongside a multicultural society, an open society, a liberal society, are losing very quickly their political power. They already are absent from the higher echelons of the Secret Service, of the Mossad, of the army, of the political important political junctures where policies are taking place. Now, this kind of Israel, the Judea Israel, if you want, would be find it even more and more difficult. They don't even believe it's important to have international legitimacy, but they would find it more and more difficult to get this legitimacy, which means a lot of other people would leave, would not want to stay, regardless of the situation with the Palestinians. It's just not the kind of place they want. And if they have the money, if they have the passports, if they have the profession that can relocate them and their capitals outside, they will do it. So I can see a drain of a certain group of Israelis who are the elite and who pay 80% of the Israeli taxes outside of Israel. And so I think it's a process of collapse that I cannot exactly predict how it would look at the end of the collapse, but I can definitely point to the cracks in the building, if you want, and they're getting wider and wider. The one thing I would just like to add is that when such a structure collapses or even weakens to such a level, it creates a void. And if the Palestinian National Movement is not there to fill the void, this is a chaos that can continue. So it's not always an assured formula for building something new unless there is, you know, a preparedness for that kind of historical reality unfolding. But I do believe that this is not, it's not sustainable. It's not working anymore.
Do you see in terms of, I assume you closely observe the Israeli press and media, and of course you have still connections to a country you were born in. Do you see Israelis talking about this among themselves? Is this, you know, it's a common thing for people to say, oh, you know, a lot of Israelis have second passports, which is true. A lot don't, particularly the Arab Jews or the Jews from Arab countries are the least likely to have second passports, probably. But Jews who have connections to North America, Canada, Europe, and so on do. So do they talk about this? Is it already happening? Is this departure already happening? What can you tell us from your close observations of discussions within Israeli society?
Yeah. First of all, I should say that up to the 7th of October, there was already clear indications of people relocating themselves and their capital outside of Israel. Not in huge number, but in significant numbers in terms of the quality of the capital that they had and the position that they had in the Israeli economic elite. So this is a process that began before the 7th of October. In a way, the 7th of October stopped for a while in the name of, you know, a kind of instinctive unity in reaction to the 7th of October, but it is resuming. So it is happening. I think that there are two kinds of conversations in Israel that are taking place. There's one, but both conversations have something in common. And the common thing is that it's clear that the next 50 years, the only promise in the horizon that Israeli politicians and leaders have for Israelis is continued bloodshed and wars. This is very clear. And you hear it also from Israelis who support the war and probably don't have the passports to go out. They understand that Israel in the next 50 years is a state that at best defeats, if you want, its enemies, but is all the time constantly a militarized zone. Even if, you know, in a successful scenario, that you manage that. The second, that's one conversation. What can we do? This is our life. some of them would buy into Netanyahu's idea that this is the lot of Jews because of anti-Semitism and there's nothing you can do. I think there is another conversation which says, is it really the only way to live? Again, I would have loved to say that this has anything to do with compassion towards the Palestinians, realization of the criminality towards the Palestinians. It is not yet. Who knows? Maybe this will come as well. But for the time being, it's just a realistic a view at a situation where, especially after the 7th of October, you say to yourself, so this is my life now. So if I love military life, and some people do, and I love wars, and I love, you know, if I like that kind of existence, yes, maybe I'm in the right place, you know, like Sparta in ancient times. But if at all there is a modicum of desire in me to have what one should call maybe normal life, this is not the place to be in. Again, I even detach it from the Palestinians. It's almost like saying, I've built the state to be a safe haven for Jews all over the world. And it is the most dangerous place for Jews to be in right now. And that's a contradiction you don't easily gloss over.
Yeah.
And the numbers are very clear. So this is not something you fabricate. You can easily, they know it. It's not very safe to be an Israeli Jew. It's the only place where it's not really safe. They are exaggerating anti-Semitism elsewhere. Jews are not killed, are not being attacked, apart from very small individual numbers, because they are part of an alien, oppressive colonialist presence in the midst of the Arab world. They have created insecurity for them, which unfortunately also radiates and projects on some Jewish communities in the world as well.
And yet Biden himself has said that there is no safe place but Israel for Jews all over the world. I mean,
Biden has said cities. So many things. He said he's a Zionist president. Right. Can tell him that the World Zionist Congress is looking for a new president.
right in.
I mean, what American politicians have said since the 7th of October, especially Secretary of State and the president, really, I mean, this is beyond anything we're used to. You know, I just finished a book which will come out in the end of the month called Lobbying for Zionism on Two Sides of the Atlantic, examining the history of lobbying for Zionism, both in Britain and the United States. And there were such moments of pathetic expressions by American leaders, but I think nothing comes close to what we've heard from American leadership since the 7th of October, especially in the first 2 months.
I wanted to quickly ask you about, I mean, you know, you were talking about Israelis leaving and you know, escaping you know, what they don't, what you know, this fantasy that was never realized, obviously, as a settler colony. But what do you think are the prospects of the settlers, you know, who have been evacuated from the kibbutzes around Gaza and also in the north of historic Palestine? Do you think they'll ever go back? Where do you think the maps will be redrawn once this is over?
Yeah. Very difficult to say. I mean, some of the people in the envelope area are coming from development towns. So they don't have that many options to live elsewhere. So I think they will return. The members of the kibbutzim, I think some of them will not. The north is a big question. As far as they're concerned, unless Israel occupies south of Lebanon, they're not going back. So the Israeli government is really a huge challenge there. It just adds to the other challenges. But you have to remember that the main problem is not so much how the map would look like. I think there's a much more fundamental problem for Israel. The government is not functioning. There's no government. It doesn't function. The only services people, the only effective service Israeli Jews receive are from the civil society. I mean, it is a civil society that is you know, experience in situations of war and emergencies, and therefore it reacts and was able to provide food, housing, and so on, which the government should have done. But the government is not functioning. It has a lot to do with the personality of the prime minister, but not only. So I think that no less important is not only the question whether they will return or not, whether Israel would return to what it used to be, at least an effective state, at least as far as its Jewish citizens were concerned. We are now nearly half a year since the 7th of October, and there's no indication for it. And we know how Israeli electoral system works with a coalition government.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bengert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, told the UN's Human Rights Council yesterday that she believed that Israel's military campaign in Gaza since October 7th amounted to genocide. The 1948 Genocide Convention, enacted in the wake of the Nazi Holocaust, defines genocide as, quote, acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. During the briefing, Albanese said, quote, I find that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the commission of the crime of genocide against Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met, end quote. She called on countries to immediately impose sanctions and an arms embargo. Israel did not attend the session and rejected her findings. In domestic news, yesterday afternoon, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit targeting an Ohio bill banning gender-affirming care for transgender youth. The suit was filed on behalf of two families whose children, the ACLU says, quote, are at risk of losing critical, medically necessary health care. The suit calls Ohio House Bill 68 unlawful under four provisions of the state constitution, including an equal protection clause. The suit asks a Columbus area county court to temporarily block the bill from taking effect and to ultimately declare it unconstitutional. Ohio's GOP Attorney General Dave Yost said in a statement that he does intend to defend the law in court. Ohio is the 23rd state to ban gender-affirming care for youth. Texas Republicans were dealt another setback late yesterday when a federal appeals court rejected the state's request to temporarily allow it to enforce a controversial immigration law. The ruling means the law, known as Senate Bill 4, will continue to be suspended as a legal challenge winds through the courts. The law would authorize state and local police to arrest people suspected of illegally crossing the U.S. southern border. The Biden administration has argued that the law unconstitutionally infringes on federal authority over immigration policy and enforcement. Yesterday's ruling by judges on the Fifth Circuit is far from the final move by that court. Judges will hear arguments on the Texas law's constitutionality on April 3rd, and then hear a separate case in May on the state's use of razor wire and river buoys to block migrants. The U.S. Coast Guard late yesterday transitioned from an active search to a recovery effort for six construction workers who are now presumed dead and who were on Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge when it collapsed yesterday after one of its support pillars was struck by a container ship that lost power. Meanwhile, the National Transportation Safety Board has recovered the ship's black box data recorder, which will help develop a timeline of events leading up to the crash as investigators seek to understand what caused it. And a report released today estimates that 19% of the food produced around the world went to waste in 2022. According to the UN Environment Program's Food Waste Index report, that's equivalent to around 1.05 billion metric tons of food. The report found that the biggest contributor to total was households, which accounted for 60% of food waste. Around 30% came from food services such as restaurants, and the remaining came from retailers. The report comes at a time when 783 million people around the world face chronic hunger, and many places face deepening food crises. It also comes amid growing concern about the environmental toll overall of food production and the greenhouse gas emissions it produces. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 48 degrees and rainy. In New York City, 52 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.